Dr. Eugene Matlov is the president of the nonprofit New Energy Foundation, and he has held the position of editor-in-chief of Infinite Energy magazine since 1995. Dr. Matlov holds a Master of Science degree and a Bachelor of Science degree in aeronautical and astronautical engineering from MIT, and a science doctorate in environmental health sciences from Harvard University. Dr. Matlov has experience in high technology engineering companies, including Hughes Research Laboratories, the Analytic Science Corporation, and MIT Lincoln Laboratory. Since 1991, he has worked as a consultant to corporations and investment firms doing and planning R&D in new energy. He has taught science journalism at MIT and at Boston University, and he was chief science writer at the MIT News Office when cold fusion erupted. And prior to that, he was a top science writer and broadcaster with the Voice of America in Washington, D.C. He's also the author of three science books and has written several science and technology articles for magazines and newspapers. Knows what he's talking about. Dr. Matlov, welcome to Coast. How are you?
Absolutely delighted to be on your program, George, and I'm fine here in New Hampshire, 2 a.m., of course, a little after.
It was interesting tonight where John Kerry, in one of his acceptance speeches in the five states that he took tonight, said that cars should be built in Detroit, but we shouldn't be taking oil from the Middle East anymore. It sure would be better if we just develop a different form of fuel, wouldn't it?
Absolutely, except the great problem with statements that many of the candidates have been making are that they refer only to what you might call conventional alternative energies, such as solar power, wind power, and the so-called hydrogen power that they talk about. Hydrogen power, in the conventional sense, is only an energy storage mechanism. It is not an energy source per se, unless you get the hydrogen from fossil fuels, which some of the fuel cell people are talking about. In order to make hydrogen from water, by conventional means, you need much greater energy from some other source, like nuclear power, standard nuclear power, or solar power, or something else. So a lot of what one hears the candidates in this presidential quest talking about may sound good and green, so to speak, but it is actually not very productive at all.
And to those who aren't in the know or study or read or even listen to programs like this or words that you speak, they will hear this rhetoric and they'll go, oh, this is great. Yep. You know, I'm all behind this person.
That's right, indeed. In fact, I can tell you of a very interesting experience we had recently. I, almost as a hobby, because I don't really expect much from presidential candidates of any party or of any stripe. Our nonprofit New Energy Foundation, of course, has to be nonpartisan. I do have my own political views, but they're not important. But I do go out from time to time, and I look at the presidential candidates, because in New Hampshire, that's very easy to do. You just turn around, and there's another one standing there. But basically, I go to various events and try to raise the question of really new energy, what we're talking about, the kind of things that you introduced, the cold fusion, which is better called low-energy nuclear reactions now, vacuum energy or ether energy, and even a profound environmental energy, sort of violations or extensions of the second law of thermodynamics, things that will lead to truly remarkable infinite energy sources that do not rely on the normal limitations of windmills and conventional solar power. So I recently asked, there were three candidates at a forum, and this was on January 9th in Concord, and I posed a question which the moderator so kindly asked the candidates. He basically said this: would you support an office within the United States Department of Energy to evaluate what might be called unconventional energy sources, not merely renewable sources such as wind power, but such things as cold fusion, so-called zero-point or vacuum energy? 30 seconds. Okay. And we had three candidates. There were only three at this particular forum. And they gave their answers, and each one had a positive response. Of course, they didn't really know precisely what we were talking about.
They're hoping they're answering it the right way.
Right. may I quote what Edward said?
You may, sure.
Because it shows that even though the spirit is there, the knowledge isn't. And if we could only get the knowledge in, and perhaps by a program such as we're having now, listeners out there visiting other primaries will actively introduce the same kind of question into the arena, and we'll actually get these guys to talk about it. Here's what Edwards said. Before I answer that question, I want these two, and he turned to Lieberman and Kucinich, tell me what the definition of cold fusion to zero point is. And then the audience laughed. Yeah, I got a feeling, listening to those answers, the two previous ones, that they don't have any idea of what it is. Then Kucinich got up and whispered something to Edwards, and then Edwards continued. Yes, of course, and the answer is yes. I would support an office that worked on alternative sources of energy. That's the answer to the question. There we have it.
And there it was.
Right.
Nice and vague and marshmallowy.
Right. Well, yeah. Hey, listen, Clinton in that very same room, Bill Clinton, before he was nominated, long before he was nominated, this was January 1992, in that very same room in Concord, New Hampshire, had given a much more precise answer to my then almost exclusive focus on the cold fusion matter. And he actually kind of knew what it was, and he knew that the Department of Energy was stonewalling even his scientists in Arkansas. So he knew what was going on and still did nothing.
I'll tell you what, Doctor, in one of the big problems, as we all know, which eventually this nation is going to have to recognize, is the tremendous power and clout of oil companies in this country that control destiny. And as you well know, Eisenhower once said a long, long time ago that we need to be aware of the industrial military complex. And, mm-hmm. and his fear always was, is those companies that benefited by war would indeed be in charge. And darn if he wasn't right.
Well, yeah, he was right in many respects, but he was a slightly off target. His rifle, he was probably a good soldier and a good marksman, but his shot in that particular speech was slightly off, in that what we really have today, I would say, not so much the oil companies opposing this. In fact, they're not really. As far as they're concerned, it's dead. But actually, academic and government complex. The academic government complex is what did in, so to speak, the proper evaluation and continued research into the initial announcement of cold fusion back on March 23rd, 1989.
But is there an anti-coal fusion lobby that might be funded by big oil companies?
No, not at all.
Okay.
There's an anti-coal fusion lobby that is funded regularly by Uncle Sam. And I don't want to make too much of this. Some of my subscribers have advised me on this program going on before to accentuate the positive, and I will accentuate the positive until...
Don't you hold back.
Yeah, but I want to tell you...
For 3 hours tonight.
But we need... Okay, fine. But we do need some background here, because after all, I myself was a very conventional, mainstream, so to speak, thinker in science prior to March 23rd, 1989, and even for a year after March 23rd, 1989, when I was trying to determine for myself the truth or falsity of the claims from Drs. Pons and Fleischmann and their people who replicated or were claiming to replicate their results, I just believed that the scientific establishment was pretty much on the up and up, and that they would, of course, address a new claim
mm-hmm.
with justice and with curiosity.
Sure, their ears would be perked.
Oh, absolutely. And they would have a new field. They always claim to be interested in new frontiers. But I found, to my great dismay, increasingly, that they were not interested in new things, really. They were interested primarily in getting rid of a new idea that quite radically upset their apple cart. The people that were most threatened by this and who acted in the most egregious negative way were my former friends at MIT in the hot fusion program. MIT gets tens of millions of dollars every year to research how to make multi-million degree, 200 million degree Kelvin temperatures to create the kind of fusion that they believe is going on in the core of the sun, and to create helium. And that would indeed be an infinite supply of of energy from water because the fuels are in water.
Sure.
But they haven't succeeded, and they've spent, in the United States alone, an estimated $20 billion since the early 1950s.
And they're still going at it?
Still going at it, and when Pons and Fleischmann came out with that astounding announcement 12 hours before the Exxon Valdez ran aground, mm-hmm. most ironically, they were shocked. Now, they didn't believe it, and they immediately assembled all reasons to doubt it, first from a theoretical point of view, and then they began to bring up all kinds of bogus, and in some cases, quite bluntly, fraudulent reasons against Pons and Fleischmann for throwing the whole thing into the trash can. The U.S. Department of Energy made a rush to judgment. Within 6 months, they had a negative report, and that stamp of disapproval has lasted since then.
Well, when this started, and what year was that?
1989.
All right.
March 23rd, 1989, in the afternoon, in Salt Lake City, this astounding announcement came from two world-class chemists.
Whatever happened to them?
Well,
they're still alive?
Absolutely. Dr. Fleischmann, in particular, a fellow of the Royal Society, one of the world's most famous electrochemists, a brilliant man, and it was his driving force that brought the idea initially to the fore. Though he worked with Dr. Stanley Pons, then an American, who was the head of the chemistry department at the University of Utah. They're both alive. Dr. Fleischmann, as I said, attends regularly all the international meetings. He participates in the Italian program. There's a small official Italian program in this area, just, you know, several million dollars a year, and it's kind of mislabeled. It's not given the cold fusion or low energy nuclear reactions name, but it's there nonetheless. And Stanley Pons, I regret to say, changed his citizenship, but I do understand his feelings. Early in the 90s, he was sick and tired of being called a fraud. So he moved to France with Dr. Fleischmann and worked under Japanese auspices, Toyota, Minoru Toyota, the late one of the
founders
of Toyota,
right.
Funded them in a laboratory in the south of France, in Nice, for many years. And they had great success. And their work was even published in peer-reviewed journal, Physics Letters A, in 1993. And still, that had no effect. Getting back to our original issue here, the academic government complex, not the military-industrial complex as much as the academic government complex, is against new scientific ideas that threaten the foundations of their work, and they, no matter how many papers are published, I don't care whether they're on the internet or not on the internet or where they are, the establishment academic government complex is brain dead.
I mean, why can't they open their arms and say, this is exciting, let's try it, let's experiment, and let's jump in it?
It's remarkable. I must tell you, George, 15 years, almost 15 years now, after that fateful day of March 23rd, 1989, I continue to evolve in my understanding of the emotional and psychological and intellectual armoring, to borrow a term from the famous Wilhelm Reich, that scientists have. It's astounding. One physicist at MIT, whose name is Dr. Hermann Feschbach, one of the world's foremost nuclear physics people. Now he's deceased. But at MIT, as I was finishing up my time there as a senior person in the MIT news office as a science journalist, he had played a role in getting rid of a major article that was going to appear in the MIT magazine, a very influential magazine called Technology Review. It's on newsstands all over the place. He said to me, I've had 50 years of experience in nuclear physics, and I know what's possible and what's not possible. And then that was it. That was his total statement, which I would cite forever
yeah.
as a a statement, a kind of statement that should never come out of the mouth of any person who considers themselves a legitimate scientist. They're not a scientist if they say, based on previous knowledge and theory that I have, I know for all time what is possible and what's not. That's obviously crazy.
I know you had just mentioned, by the way, Dr. Wilhelm Reich, who's now deceased as well.
Absolutely.
And didn't he come up with a theory of what he called orgone?
Absolutely, orgone, right.
And they put him in jail over this, right?
Yes, it's a complicated story as to how he arrived in prison. He lived, by the way, for those who don't really know much about Reich and who may think Reich was a completely deluded person. I didn't know much about him myself, quite frankly, until about the year 2000, long after my entry into the cold fusion field. He would live between 1897 and 1957. He was a close colleague of Sigmund Freud. He was an assimilated Jewish person from Austria. He left Germany, obviously, early on and worked in Denmark and Norway.
He was a psychiatrist first,
He was a psychiatrist. He had many ideas of sexuality, well, some of which today are quite commonly accepted, actually, in many, many circles
mm-hmm.
today. You sort of speak maybe a modern forerunner of the, generally speaking, more sexually liberal ideas that many people today may have.
He was the early version of the Masters and Johnson.
Perhaps, you might say. how he got involved in a more physics-based and biology-based study of nature is quite one of the most amazing stories that one could ever imagine. But his work has been taken up by others, and we'll have time to talk about that.
Yeah.
But why did he get in jail? In 1957, he was put in jail for contempt of court. And this originated from his statement that he would not allow any court to be the adjudicator of a scientific issue, which in general terms I agree with.
Sure.
In other words, what the hell is a court doing to determine a major scientific question? Well, at that time, he and other physicians in a network were studying the effects of so-called orgone accumulators, these little chambers that one could get into of a special design, and he was determining the physiological effect on various maladies, was not selling it as a cancer cure, but some left-winger went after him and called sick the FDA on him, actually.
And they put him in jail over that.
Put him in jail, and he died in prison.
And took all his equipment, and nobody ever found it again.
They did not take his equipment, actually. They burned his books. He was the only scientist in history, I believe, who had his books burned in Nazi Germany, Soviet Union, and the United States. There was a court order, believe it or not, in the United States. It's hard to conceive of this, but there was, to burn and get rid of certain books that he had written with the word orgone in it.
All right, we'll come right back because I want to really talk with you now about these other alternative forms of energy that you're talking about, Eugene, and just see how close we are to implementing some of this, or if we ever will be. And also, I'm going to ask you about peaking oil, because that's something that has kind of piqued my interest, and I want you to see if you can explain to us what that means, peaking oil. Well, hello, this is Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie with Dr. Eugene Mallow tonight, my guest. Doctor, I guess for us to really get going into this, I want you to tell us a little bit about the New Energy Foundation, what it is, when it was formed, and why.
Well, we've been publishing Infinite Energy magazine for a number of years now, anyway, since 1995, and we're going into our 10th year soon. But in the year 2002, we decided that a better basis for it, rather than having it nonprofit and have it owned by a company that was titled Cold Fusion Technology, it would be much better to have it nonprofit as it is now, 501c3, so charitable contributions will have their effect. And we are doing two things, continuing. We are continuing, of course, to publish Infinite Energy Magazine, which goes to some 40-plus countries, actually, recipients thereof. We have rather small print runs, but still it's very influential. Many thousands of people see it and buy it. But at the same time, we wanted to raise money so that we could give money away in the form of research grants to inventors and scientists who are doing critically needed research, because certainly the government is not directly funding this. At least the United States government is not, certainly the Department of Energy is not funding it. There have been some military quasi-surreptitious givings of money for the low-energy nuclear reactions area, but there's really nothing being spent by the government. So we at New Energy Foundation get a pool of money, are in the process of trying to assemble that so that in the initial stages we could hopefully reach something on the order of $500,000 a year to be given away, awarded to specific recipients who merit this. Now, we get all manner of inquiries, I hasten to say, particularly since we're on the air here, of all manner of people who think they have some over-unity device, something that produces more energy out than in. And we always take a very objective look at it, providing that they, under non-disclosure or with no non-disclosure, bring it to our attention and show the measurements, show us the measurements or let us measure it, and then find out whether their ideas are worthwhile.
Because there could be another Joseph Popp out there somewhere, right? And we'll talk about him later.
Absolutely. We never throw anything out, no matter how crazy it sounds on first blush, unless the person is obviously disturbed, okay, or purely driven by blather and emotionality. We want to see data, results. We can sometimes agree to a situation where we get a black box, as it were, where we are not allowed to look inside, but we can evaluate its performance, the input and the output, the weighing of it, and making sure that some truly incredible performance is occurring. That rarely happens, by the way, because most inventors, a lot of inventors, either will not share with us their
proprietary
their work. They won't even let us test it, in which case, forget it.
Yeah, exactly. It's got to be tested.
We have wasted a lot of time with people who just, were on very thin ice to begin with, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Quite damaging. And now, after many years of the School of Hard Knocks, we know what's real when we see it and test it, and what's not real.
Have you had some intriguing people come in?
We've had very intriguing people come in. We've had one especially intriguing person who came in, who to this day is probably doing some good work. We understand. We follow their trail, as it were.
Yeah.
But I have to say, with respect to this Mr. X, let's call this particular, actually I don't want to call him Mr. X to confuse people, but a certain party, a nice scientific man who had certain ether vacuum energy kind of ideas.
He's an American, right?
American, yes, okay. Doing a lot of experiments. And to this day, I have not been presented with the kind of material and information necessary to evaluate his work. But if he calls me on the phone or his associates call me on the phone, I always talk with them and I ask them about the latest status of the work. I mean, that's a clear case where the guy might well have something and is worth pursuing because we know he's scientifically based, but show us the evidence.
Doesn't that make you suspect when they don't do that?
It gives me some pause, yes, indeed. And so, for example, I could never state to anybody today that this particular person, let's call him Mr. G to distinguish, Mr. G has not shown us the measurements and the devices that we need to see. But perhaps someday he will break down and show it to us. He's very friendly to us, so I don't have a problem. On the other hand, we have people, excellent people, who have allowed me to come into their laboratory, measure their machines, and observe what they're doing, and read their theories, and see in intimate detail, almost as detailed as I could possibly wish, so that I can confidently assert that they indeed have vacuum energy technology. There are people like that.
I've got a pill that you can drop in the water. It turns it into fuel, but I'm not going to show you how it works.
Right. No, we're not talking about people like that. We wouldn't talk. We would certainly go to such a demonstration if a person had such a pill, but we would not spend too much time if we were not allowed to test it independently.
So as you proceed, as you kind of wean out these people,
yeah.
Why isn't our government saying, this is critical, we need to do this? Or are they doing it somewhere, doctor, in a laboratory at Area 51? Yeah. Nobody knows what they're doing.
Well, let's put that second question aside, whether the government sort of has it under its arm in the first place. That's an interesting question. I doubt it, quite frankly, but I'm open to the possibility that they have. Let's just talk about, to start with, the first thing that got my interest, of course, which was cold fusion.
And explain what that is.
Well, Drs. Pons and Fleischmann made the claim in 1989, and they published a scientific paper in the Journal of Electroanalytical Chemistry pretty quickly thereafter, after the press conference. They said, look, we're passing an electric current into an electrochemical cell which has palladium for one of its electrodes and platinum for another electrode. And this heavy water, which is obtainable from all water, it's not radioactive, it's normal stuff that you can get from the ocean or from snow or streams. Small percentage of water is heavy water. It's got the heavy hydrogen isotope, basically, D2O, not H2O. And what we see is more energy out than in. In other words, more heat energy is coming out than electrical energy is going in. Now, when you do an experiment like that with a heat measuring calorimeter, you have to be very careful because there are some bookkeeping errors of the production of hydrogen and oxygen that you can fool yourself with. So that was indeed a fair initial question. Are they doing the bookkeeping correctly? And they were world-class electrochemists. They knew about those bookkeeping possible errors, but they had obviously checked that out very carefully before they made their announcement. And they found that the amount of heat coming out, even though it was, relatively speaking, a small excess percentage, but when it persisted over many, many days, weeks, and months even, that you add it up, and it basically told them there's some kind of energy source in here. We don't know exactly what it is, but it's not standard chemistry. It mm-hmm. looks to us like a nuclear source, and they had some other evidence, radioactive tritium that was produced, and some what they believe to be neutron emissions that they correlated to some extent, not in the conventional fusion reaction, but some new kind of fusion reaction. So it's a complicated story, but in essence, they announced that they had created a nuclear kind of probable fusion-type reaction in a jar of water. This was guaranteed to create instant controversy.
Without the danger of radiation, let's say?
Correct. Okay. That is correct. In fact, the establishment brought forth the argument against them, an absurd argument, but this is what it amounts to. They said, since we, great nuclear physicists and hot fusion people, understand everything there is to know about fusion, and we can tell you that the only way you could possibly be getting the heat that you say you're getting would be to have a corresponding amount of deadly radiation. Since you're alive, your results, your measurements must be wrong. In other words, they did not even admit the possibility that Drs. Fleischmann and Pons might have discovered or stumbled across an entirely new way of doing nuclear reactions.
And they shot it down right
away. Shot it down almost on day one, sharpened the knives, and did a media campaign against it and succeeded in branding it as pathological science, fraud, scientific schlock. All these kind of words were used. But the bottom line is this. The proof now for the reality of a class of low-energy nuclear reactions is completely overwhelming. There are some 3,000 papers published. They're not all as high quality as a smaller subset of those papers. But of those papers that are really good, and there are hundreds that are, the evidence is stupendous. It would, any reasonable scientist taking an objective look at this monumental gathering of information, which we can discuss a little more, would say, yes, there's a whole class of low-energy nuclear reactions that absolutely must be investigated, and we should certainly either put on low burner or terminate, the infamous hot fusion program and save some money.
Who is beating us at this game outside of this country? Other nations?
I'll tell you the nation that is the two nations that are most likely to succeed in this, okay? Japan and China. Okay, actually, I bet more heavily on China at this point.
Which is unfortunate, but...
It is unfortunate that the United States, where this was first discovered, is going to be taken to the cleaners, so to speak, by another country that has much more open-minded scientists. For example, the 9th International Conference on Cold Fusion was held in Beijing, and I went to it, in May of 2002. And it was a completely open-minded meeting at Tsinghua University in Beijing. Scientists from around the world came, from Italy, Russia, France, Israel. Now, Israel, by the way, is a player in this. A very good, strong private company within Israel is doing this work. I'm very happy to say that. And but China had its physics societies formally sponsoring this meeting, and there's no blood in the streets in China as far as the issue of cold fusion. They don't kill each other over it, whereas in the United States, I mean, figuratively speaking, kill each other.
Sure. Well, you never know in China.
Yeah, right. Well, it's true with Tiananmen Square and what have you. But the point is, there's an open-mindedness to new technological and scientific ideas, and the Chinese people obviously are very smart. They produce very high-quality products. And when they see an opportunity here, there is absolutely no doubt in my mind that when this technology reaches a critical stage, and it may well do that in the coming years, it's still having trouble of making very reliable, robust systems, but it is absolutely real nonetheless. When they find the way to make it robust and real, they'll take off like a rocket with this.
Now, what are the applications for cold fusion in practically for all of us if this thing gets up?
Essentially, anything. Any area of energy technology that can be imagined could, in theory, be replaced by cold fusion.
You could heat your houses. You could run your cars.
Electricity. Rocket propulsion, many things. Here's the bottom line. In a gallon of water, this is an approximation because my viewpoint on this is that the cold fusion theorists, even the mainline cold fusion theorists, don't really understand the process very well at all. In fact, I think they're going, generally speaking, in the wrong direction. They're doing good work on experiments, but the theoretical foundations that they're doing have some serious problems and is causing the field to be retarded. But 1 gallon of water has in it 1/6700th of that water has molecules that contain the heavy hydrogen isotope called deuterium.
Okay.
It's hydrogen with one extra neutron in its nucleus.
All right.
And when you fuse 2 deuterium nuclei together to make helium, I'm not saying that's how it happens at the surface of palladium, but when that happens, you do get a certain amount of energy release that in the case of this type of reaction doesn't produce deadly gamma rays, but produces instead heat. All right? The amount of heat in 1 gallon of water. I'm talking ordinary water now.
Sure.
From the ocean. I want to be real clear to your listeners.
Just scoop it right up. Okay.
Just the ordinary water from the ocean, the lake, the brook, the snow, anywhere. From your local
from your
grocery
tap.
Store.
Okay.
Okay. 300 gallons of gasoline equivalent.
My, oh my. And it's...
Keep that
it's,
in mind. That number, if any listener today,
300
your program, remembers anything of what I'm saying, please remember that one number, that in the United States, a discovery that was made that was announced in 1989, ridden out of town with ridicule, so to speak, by the U.S. Department of Energy and its idiotic academic slaves, as it were.
Well, 2 gallons of water might last you an entire year if you drive 18,000 miles, for example.
Oh, of course.
If you're getting 30 miles to a gallon...
No. Right. Energy would be free. Energy would be free for all practical purposes.
Ah, but that's why it's not out there, Eugene.
Well, of course, they will have to tax it. And even if we had cold fusion devices tomorrow, I assure you that the government would find some way of taxing it, because they would have to find some way of continuing the support, of course, to keep up the interstate highway system.
I would still pay the same money I'm paying for gasoline, which I think is outrageous.
Uh-huh.
I would still pay that for this kind of fuel.
Of course, because it would be clean.
Yep.
There would be no emissions of either particles of soot or nitrogen oxide.
And you wouldn't be dependent on anyone.
That's correct. Saudi Arabia, Kuwait,
Iraq, any of them.
They could kiss our sweet, you know what. We could say goodbye, folks. In fact, the thing that outrages me the most about this is that we could have, many years ago, even when the days when Saddam was in power, okay, and a horrible dictator and a complete megalomaniac he was, and I'm glad he's gone, okay, but the point of the matter is we could have, the United States government could have begun to quietly tell Saudi Arabia, Iraq, all these countries that have us by the soft spots, in a few more years, not too many more, we will have this problem solved, and we're not going to be dependent on you at all. And that goes for you, too, companies in the United States,
mm-hmm.
that think that we're going to be eternally beholden to oil interests. We're not. We will eat oil for food.
We use it for plastics, right?
Use it for plastics, but we're not going to use it for combustion, which is an absurd use, particularly in an age when we have discoveries like cold fusion, and I haven't even discussed vacuum energy yet.
That's when we come back.
We're going to talk about those too. But here, the thing about cold fusion that's wonderful, low energy nuclear reactions, LENR, and apart from our website, infinite-energy.com, which will refer people to all websites with new types of energy, the primary website that deals with LENR is called LENR-CANR.org. And if you go to that website, you'll have numerous PDF file technical reports, original reports, just like on our website, but they have a primary focus on cold fusion, LENR. The technical papers that scientists and engineers can eat up and see for themselves the reality of this emerging field. And that's the paradigm. One case, okay, of new energy, radically new energy, as we call it, unconventional energy, not standard alternative energy, that's the one case that is overwhelmingly documented across a huge variety of publications, countries, and what have you. And it's a disgrace, an absolute disgrace, that in our country, the U.S. Department of Energy will not relook at the original disaster that they perpetrated with their negative report.
Okay, let's talk. Dr. Eugene Mallove, my guest. Gene, before we get into some of the other two different kinds of energies and possibilities, why can't we do cold fusion, though, in a mass-produced way? I mean, what's holding us back from doing it? Is it money? Is the technology just not there yet?
It's a little bit of both. You know, cold fusion actually probably partakes a little of the other kinds of energy. In other words, there's a unified physics, let's face it. The basic problem that we're facing is that our primary physics model of quantum mechanics, relativity, and many other things has some fundamental flaws. That's at root what's going on. The theorists, the mainstream theorists within cold fusion, have a certain idea that when you load up a metal lattice like palladium or titanium or something like that, you can get certain types of quantum mechanical coherence phenomena that
mm-hmm.
produces this reaction. And they're driving, to some extent, the mental paradigm of this. But in actuality, the experimental techniques in cold fusion are all what we would call empirical. In other words, no one really understands at all, okay, in the cold fusion mainstream per se. They do not understand at all how it is working at a fundamental level. Now, in general, I would agree that you don't need to know for sure how something is working in order to make it commercial, providing that the nature of the reaction is powerful enough so that it goes. Like, for example, you don't need to understand fire to use fire.
Right.
Right?
You just,
but,
yeah, you're right.
Right. You just strike the match and it works.
Yep.
Okay, fine. Okay, everyone realizes.
And you depend on it.
Right, and you don't even know how to, you don't need to know how radio works or TV works in order to enjoy radio and TV.
That is true.
Now, if someone over the last 15 years had been able to create a very practical device that could sit on your desk, or even one that you could sell to as a demonstration kit, as it were, to physicists, doubters, and so forth,
mm-hmm.
we would have won the war already. But we have not been able to do that. It's very sporadic. Now, there are some scientists, I'll quote one in particular, I'll cite one in particular, one of the best, and we've given him $10,000 recently, which, of course, is nothing, but it helps him keep alive.
What do they do with that? They live off it, or they buy
well,
equipment?
Well, yeah, Dr. Mitchell Swartz, for example, in Massachusetts, not far from where we are, is an MIT graduate. He, at the 10th International Conference, had a device working around the clock that was producing several times the input energy consistently. And he can do that consistently.
Yeah.
He's one person who can do it consistently. But let me tell you, many of the other people in cold fusion, for example, are ignoring his work. So, you know, one guy in the field, laboriously after many years, comes up with a way of doing it fairly consistently, and then he gets ignored by everybody else. But, for example, he probably, among them all, has probably the best shot. So what could be done, for example, with Dr. Swartz, is that, let us say he received some further generous donations from us, or perhaps some investor would work with him to help him, because he's, you know, like a one-man or two-man shop, basically.
Right.
Get him going and get these, let's call them demonstration kits out there, which could go into high schools and colleges and so forth, so they could see a more robust version. There are high school students. We funded also Dr. Professor John Dash of Portland State University in Oregon. He had many students, high school students, interns, work on this, and they're continuing to work on it. They came to the 10th International Conference, and they have a little demonstration, not as powerful as Dr. Swartz's, but it shows excess heat for sure. And, you know, any high school student could do this. But that still leaves the question of where do we go from there? Yes, that might trigger further widespread belief in it, whereas now there's no belief, no acceptance by the dogmatic colleges and high schools that have just absorbed this garbage from the U.S. Department.
So there are no emerging public companies? I mean, you
yes,
know,
there is one. One is called Blacklight Power Corporation.
Okay.
Now, they do not like at all the word cold fusion. In fact, they claim not to be doing cold fusion, and I don't believe they are doing cold fusion. They have, under the auspices of Dr. Randall Mills, a brilliant man with some MIT training in electrical engineering, but an MD from Harvard University, 1991, 2 years into the cold fusion controversy, he came out with a general idea that the explanation that the cold fusion people were giving to the phenomena was not on target. He believes that the structure of the hydrogen atom is different, and he's assembled a team of PhD scientists in Cranberry, New Jersey, at the Blacklight Power Corporation. They have excess energy in plasmas, gas, high-temperature gas, that are using hydrogen and using noble gases like helium as catalysts, and are producing some rather spectacular results. They, however, have not got their energy density up. They're more reliable than cold fusion per se, in my opinion. They do it every single time. They have industrial partners. They have laboratories around the world that have replicated their work. And quite frankly, that is an avenue for at least a commercial investment perspective. That is one that people should look into.
But
it's a privately held company.
But
so.
This is not public then. And, but
no, not yet.
And venture capitalists aren't throwing money at,
nope.
at emerging
nope.
companies.
No, you know where the venture capitalists are throwing their money? Well, of course, on damned hydrogen fuel cells. Now, what are hydrogen fuel cells? Hydrogen fuel cells are advanced technology that we've used to go to the moon. You know, we've used them in spacecraft, electrical power generation. You take oxygen with you, you take hydrogen with you, and you combine them together through membranes, and you get electricity, and you get water as a byproduct. Wonderful. But somebody has to make the hydrogen. And there's no such thing on Earth as a hydrogen mine, really, not a prominent hydrogen mine. We have hydrogen in water, and you need more energy to break that water into oxygen and hydrogen than you will get back when you recombine them in a fuel cell. So the people who are investing in fuel cells, indeed, it's a good technology, and they'll probably do very well.
And clean, right?
And it's clean where you burn it.
Where
you use the fuel cell. So indeed, if we had a magic wand, could convert every car to fuel cells overnight, we could, and had hydrogen supplies for them, okay, provided, of course, in conventional use by other energy sources, we indeed could clean up the air in Los Angeles and Mexico
City.
Sure,
but you might need fossil fuels to make it, right?
Correct. Or we would use fossil fuels. Some of the fuel cell people say, well, we just take the hydrogen off the hydrocarbon molecules. Well, now, here's the problem. Why are these companies totally ignoring this other process that I've been talking about, namely low-energy nuclear action?
Mm-hmm,
the reason they're ignoring it, and to some extent they're correct, it has been problematic. In other words, it's not screaming out that, okay, we've solved all the problems. Now, either they don't believe it, and in many cases they don't, okay, or they assimilated the idea that it's nonsense and they're not working on it, or they see that there are indeed a lot of problems, and there are. So what is going to cure, what is going to turn around in that particular area of new energy? The only thing that can turn that around is the emergence in the field of a robust device of some kind. So some venture capitalist and or a philanthropist, and I hope for the philanthropist much more than I hope for venture capitalists. I think most venture capitalists are significantly brain dead. Listen, all you have to realize is that they've pissed off, pardon my French, huge quantities of money in the dot-com fiasco,
yes,
right?
Yes.
All right?
They got burned there.
A minor fraction of that money, an infinitesimal fraction of that money, might well have solved the entire coal fusion research problem.
Mm-hmm.
But try to get those people to the well. Believe me, we've set up all kinds of attempts to get venture capital in. Some has flown in.
And they don't understand it, first of all.
Right. Well, $20 or $30 million was invested, and wisely so, in my opinion, into the Blacklight Power Corporation of Cranberry, New Jersey.
Okay, the one you just mentioned.
Which is linked to our website. We link to their website. And they have spectacular results that are like clockwork predictable. Now, there should be hundreds of millions of dollars put into that company. Not just, you know, $10, $20, $30 million. I mean, this stuff that Dr. Mills and company is working on is fantastic.
Because what happens when they run out of funds?
Well, indeed, what happens when they run out of funds? And they are routinely attacked by the academic government complex. There are people who literally monitor them. We know who they are, okay? Robert Park of the American Physical Society, nitwit if there ever was one. He wrote the book called Voodoo Science, which supposedly debunks coal fusion, complementary medicine, Blacklight Power Corporation's work. Everything that this nitwit doesn't understand is debunked.
Okay, don't hold back at all here.
No, I won't. I'll be a little more blunt about it in the future. No, seriously, money is indeed a choking point. I don't want to be crass about it and say, look, send money. This will solve the problem. We still have issues that won't be solved, but believe me, these coal fusion researchers and the Blacklight Power Corporations of the world and the vacuum energy people that I'd like to talk about soon, the Correas in Canada, Toronto, Canada, they're basically starving for money for the kind of work that could take us rather quickly, in many cases, particularly in the vacuum energy area, from no visibility to extreme visibility.
Quickly, too. Well, now, what about my question from last hour about a clandestine government operation going on somewhere where they're doing this right now?
Right. Well, anything is possible. For example, I'm not going to get into the UFO question, which I find to be very interesting.
No, but I will ask you an alien question that has to do with let me do that now and get it out of the way. Sure, if there were an alien civilization,
and there certainly are,
a 100,000 years ahead of us, what kind of energy sources do you think they'd be using?
Vacuum energy. There's no question about it.
Okay.
There's absolutely no doubt, zero doubt in my mind, and I'm the author of the Starflight Handbook, of a very mainstream, technical, popular book on interstellar flight, by the way. I would say all the proposals that I and Dr. Matloff collected in that book are rather obsolete. We wrote that book in 1980.
And vacuum energy is also called space energy, right?
Space energy, ether energy. There is an ether. That's the bottom line. There is an ether pervading space. It is not the ether that was dismissed properly, the electromagnetic ether that the Michelson-Morley experiment of 1887.
Or the kind that puts us to sleep.
The kind that puts us to sleep. There's a pervading mass-free energy in all of the universe. There's no such thing as a Big Bang, by the way. The highly questionable theory.
Ooh, I may want to ask you that by the time we're off the air.
Right, okay. Basically, ether energy is at the root of everything. It created, the ether is responsible for the creation and destruction of matter. It is responsible for life itself. Okay, all particles are made of ether. They are not little hard things. They are the things that we call particles today, electrons and protons and so forth, are nothing but special geometries of the mass-free ether that are in a form that makes them have an inertial quality. In other words, makes them have mass. But the largest body of energy in the universe is definitely the vacuum. The vacuum is where it is. Some people have called the energy or have interpreted it from physics perspectives, as you said, zero-point energy. I don't believe that that theory, the zero-point energy theory, is the proper ether theory. But it's nonetheless a good starting point. But the bottom line is there are devices today on this planet in laboratories, not in government laboratories, that, I mean, I don't know whether the government has these things. I doubt that they do, but okay, maybe they have them. But the individuals and research teams working on devices that do not employ hydrogen for anomalous nuclear reactions, but employ nothing but electrical discharges and collections of what Reich had called orgone energy.
Mm-hmm.
These things are absolutely real. They have been verified. There is theoretical foundation for them. I have observed these experiments. I attest to them. There's even a new form in the latest issue of our magazine, issue number 53.
Does this come out every month or bimonthly?
Bimonthly.
Okay.
Okay. It's titled Solar Power by Day and by Night. Now, Dr. Paulo and Alexander Correa in Toronto, Canada, have managed to create a special type of what Reich would have called an orgone accumulator, but they call it a hybrid orgone accumulator that sits around the clock generating power in a small Stirling engine. I've worked with them, by the way, to calibrate to make sure that the experiments are being done properly. They go round the clock running a Stirling engine as though there were a source of 2 watts of thermal energy inside the metal Faraday cage. Now, that's vacuum energy for sure.
Someone's going to get a Nobel Prize one day for
this. Someday, yes.
Now, anyways, very quickly, as we approach the bottom here, government, maybe they're working on this, maybe not. What are they doing?
There have been some programs, for example, NASA had a public program, an advanced propulsion program, in which they entertained ideas of zero-point energy, vacuum energy. But I know there are people who say, absolutely, the government has these things. My good friend, Dr. Stephen Greer,
yes.
I'm very friendly with Steve and with his colleague, Professor Loder from the University of New Hampshire.
What happened there, by the way? When I interviewed
him. What happened with whom?
Stephen, he thought about a year ago, 2 years ago, he'd be coming out with an apparatus
and
something happened.
Well, I've been privy to some of this information. I keep confidential what I'm not particularly supposed to talk about.
I mean, he said he had an inventor. He said he had an inventor.
Yes, there is an inventor, and I understand that they're still having discussions with that particular inventor. I do not know precisely what that inventor has or has not. What the facts that have been told to me by Steve and his colleagues are quite impressive. But I haven't seen it myself, so I don't bless it whatsoever.
Right.
But I have also seen, I must tell you, some excellent work whereby Dr. Loader from the University of New Hampshire, who works with Dr. Greer, brought to our laboratory here at the New Energy Foundation in recent times, and we checked out a solid-state device. We're still doing some work on that. It was stated by the inventors that it was over-unity. We have yet to see the over-unity characteristic in it. Other labs are looking at it. We're going to look at it again. Until we see excess energy from it, neither Steve nor Loader nor myself nor anyone will bless it. On the other hand, there's absolutely no doubt that the devices, patented devices no less, by Dr. Paolo and Alexander Correa in Canada are over-unity. Okay, this is a clear case where vacuum energy can be seen in technically published information that is irrefutable, as far as I'm concerned, and I have personally been at the lab and seen it. There's no doubt that these machines exist. Now, Steve would say that the government has much more advanced technology, which they've maybe learned from UFOs or something.
Right.
Maybe, but what good does it do us? Is it really doing us any good? No, obviously not. My general feeling about it is that the government does not have such things.
But you believe space energy is the prime energy. It's up there at the top.
Absolutely. Definitely extraterrestrial civilizations exist. I have almost zero doubt about that, essentially zero doubt. For all practical purposes, they exist. And in fact, more evidence of that comes from the ether itself, comes from the work of Wilhelm Reich in the following sense. Life probably originates very easily from the ether, okay,
mm-hmm.
with the right conditions on Earth. Reich was among them, the people who were working on that, whereas our current model of life, the origin of life, is that it happened at one incidental point billions of years ago, and then it took a long, long time to get started. I don't believe that.
All right, stay with us. Fascinating. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Malov, let's talk a little bit more then about energy category number two, and that is zero-point energy, which we touched upon a bit, space energy. What is it? What's out there that does this?
Well, here we have to talk about, just name the fundamental theories on which mainstream physicists and chemists rely, okay, for the entire foundation of our scientific world, okay? And these theories are, at present, quantum mechanics, okay,
mm-hmm.
and relativity, the special theory of relativity
right.
that changed everyone's perspective starting around 1920 when Einstein began to become prominent. He had his theory of special relativity published in 1905, and later his general relativity theory, a theory of how so-called space-time is curved in four dimensions to give gravity and so forth. You know, there are many reasons why he became very prominent, but we need not get into them, but obviously he did become prominent, and the theory of relativity is given a lot of credence, and it basically says, as we all know, E equals mc squared. That's a simple equation that everyone can understand, that mass times the speed of light squared is the equivalent amount of energy in matter, and we rely on that, generally speaking, for explaining nuclear reactions.
And there's a lot of energy that comes out of that.
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt that nuclear reactions, both fission, gave us the atomic bomb, the fission bomb, and then thermonuclear fusion
mm-hmm.
Energy from the hydrogen bomb, and the attempts, of course, by the hot fusion community, the $20 billion attempt since 1950, to tame it and bring it down into large tokamak-type reactors. However, it turns out that after a long consideration by critics, and there have been many critics of special relativity, very sane people, not anti-Semites who were against Einstein because he was Jewish, okay, there were those.
I understand.
But you know, the Nazis called it Jewish science, for example. But people who were careful critics of relativity have not been listened to, okay, and have just been brushed aside because it was stated that the experiments all confirmed all aspects of relativity, special relativity, and there could be no doubt about it. A guy from Caltech said that, David Goodstein, the same man who said in recent times that you know he really had doubts about cold fusion, okay, so he doesn't know what he's talking about.
Right.
But it turns out that relativity is fundamentally flawed. It basically introduced the concept that there was no ether, okay, and it was true that there was no electromagnetic ether. This, the Michelson-Morley experiment and some other experiments, in my view, and the view of others who I learn from, have proved that there was no ether whereby electromagnetic waves had to vibrate in space to produce what we see of light and so forth. But this threw out the possibility that there was another kind of ether, a mass-free plenum that did not operate on electromagnetic principles, that the Michelson-Morley experiment could never detect, okay? Wilhelm Reich, a brilliant man that he was, an unusual man, because remember, he did come out of a sexual psychiatric orientation, right?
Yes.
Sigmund Freud. So who is something, some person like that to say anything about physics?
Right.
Well,
right.
In 1941, a brilliant fellow that he was, he brought some interesting observations to Einstein. He actually had 4.5 hours with Einstein. By the way, this meeting is virtually absent from all accounts of the biography of Einstein.
Why?
Because
what happened,
Reich was later disparaged. He died in prison, remember?
Yeah, okay.
He turned into, just like cold fusion, an insane pathological man.
Do you think Einstein took some ideas from him?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Einstein, he asked Professor Einstein, a colleague, of course, in the fight against fascism. Remember, this was early 1941, before the United States got into the war.
Right,
but,
okay.
Of course, both of them were opposed to the Nazis, obviously.
And well aware of what
and was well going. Aware of the possibility. So Einstein, to his credit, felt that all possibilities should be explored in the possible quest to find ways to deal with perhaps war technology and what have you. You know, his letter later on to President Roosevelt obviously helped the Manhattan Project get going.
Mm-hmm.
But here was Reich showing him a simple experiment whereby a mercury thermometer, very accurate mercury thermometer, on the surface of what we call a Faraday cage, a steel enclosure, was higher and remained higher throughout the day than a similar mercury thermometer in suspended in air. Okay, now this sounds, your listeners even who don't know about this may say, well, that sounds crazy. What could that possibly show? Well, careful experiments by Dr. Paolo and Alexandra Correa in Canada confirming this type of experiment, and in fact, giving it an even worse bias against being seen. In other words, not having the orgone accumulating layers of material around the Faraday cage, just using bare steel steel boxes, so to speak, in their laboratory, they have found persisting round-the-clock elevated temperatures on the metal Faraday cage, even in a darkened room. Now, when I first saw their ether motors and their PAGD, okay, I was obviously motivated to go back and study Reich. Prior to that, I had no interest in Reich. But I wondered, well, God, I mean, could Einstein have missed in 1941 a profound discovery? And the answer is absolutely yes.
Yep.
We cover this in our issue 37. He brought it to Einstein. Einstein confirmed, I repeat, confirmed that there was a 3/10 of a degree or more elevation on the Faraday cage. But his assistant, Einstein's assistant, Leopold Infeld, poo-pooed it. He did some half-baked experiments to suggest that, oh, yes, it's a simple explanation as to why this elevated temperature is there. And he pushed Einstein away from thinking about it and thus broke the connection, the critical connection, between Einstein and Reich, which it had persisted. And if Einstein had behaved himself and continued the correspondence, Reich did write many letters, technical letters, to Einstein, pleading with him to reevaluate the assertions, the glib assertions of Leopold Infeld. Much as today in the late 20th century and early 21st, we are pleading with scientists and political leaders to reevaluate the absurd, glib dismissal of cold fusion. Well, Einstein never did that. And so Reich went much further with this energy, the manifestation of ether energy, which initially was this elevated thermal anomaly on a very simple experiment. So just like Galileo, with his experiment of dropping a cannonball and a smaller object from the Leaning Tower of Pisa, a very simple experiment showing simultaneous arrival at the ground, making a profound change in paradigm, a simple experiment with a thermometer, which I have done myself, by the way, to my own satisfaction in my own basement, and found the same persisting thermal anomaly. And that's not all. When you elaborate that simple experiment and other experiments that Reich did with electroscopes, gold leaf electroscopes, you find huge anomalies occurring in Faraday cages. And Dr. Paolo and Alexandra Correa have in their laboratory done many further experiments to clarify some of the many, many confusions that Reich himself had about this. They have established the irrefutable presence of an ether, a mass-free ether that can be analyzed with thermometers, electroscopes, which shows that it is possible to make little motors that work on it. Earlier, they had this patented technology that I referred to called the PAGD, which has three U.S. patents, one Israel patent, and so forth, that have pulses occurring in vacuum between aluminum plates in a glass cylinder and produce more energy out than in.
Would you say that this ether is a normal occurrence in the universe?
It is.
And it's a natural thing?
It's the foundation of the universe. There is no other foundation of the universe. The myth of relativity, and relativity is wrong, it is incorrect. Indeed, its equations describe certain experiments, accelerator experiments, very accurately. There's no doubt about that.
Outcome, I guess, right?
But the theory can be wrong. In other words, an equation can give you a very precise match between an experimental result in an accelerator, as an example, and the theory, but that does not mean that the theory is fundamentally correct. In fact, it is fundamentally absolutely wrong. There is no such thing as non-simultaneity and so forth. It's all, unfortunately, a myth. One thing is for sure. If you have a motor that is working, as I have seen in their laboratory, off an orgone accumulator, in other words, one wire coming from a Faraday cage, running a motor through special electronics, patent applied for, it's not patented yet, okay? And this motor is running from an orgone accumulator, that is from an ether accumulator of latent heat, as they would say, latent heat from the ether, as one component of the ether. That's it. That ends the whole entire myth of special relativity.
Well, is there any exhaust coming off this
motor?
No, nothing.
There's nothing. So the only thing that the Correas insist upon as far as correspondence of one very fundamental law that we're all aware of, the conservation of energy law, they are 100% behind the conservation of energy. Their physics is an energy-based physics. Time and space are subsets of energy. Energy is the primary reality of the universe. The energetic ether is the primary reality of the universe.
It's not an outcome of a combination.
Right. Mass, okay. The mass energy that there is also in nuclear reactions comes ultimately from the energy of the ether.
Mm-hmm.
There is no such thing as a particle that is a point particle with a mass. So currently, modern physics says, the electron is an infinitesimal point that has a charge and that has a mass. And everyone in physics, from the most advanced universities to the lowliest high school student, learns that the electron charge is equal to the proton charge, equal and opposite sign, okay? And that it has a certain mass, which is about 2,000 times less than that of the proton, and that it has a spin and so forth. But this infinitesimal point is a fiction. It's an absolute fiction. Electrons have structure. They are structured ether constructs. And protons are too, and all the other particles are. They're really, for all practical purposes, can be no other generic kind of explanation. I am not suggesting, by the way, that Dr. Correa and Alexandra have the ultimate perfect theory, nor would they. Okay? They're open to criticism. They have a website where people can discuss things with them. But I must tell you that they are very definitely in the right, going substantially in the right direction. They are publishing work which is exemplary, pioneering, and I hope someday they are blessed with a reward for it. Because up to this point, all they've been rewarded by is abuse.
No.
In fact, abuse even by people in the cold fusion field, I regret to say.
Well, that's interesting.
Right. It's like, even the new energy field, I regret to say, has had turf wars, and they're stupid.
Sure.
Okay?
There's politics and everything.
Right. But ether, as far as advanced space flight, will seriously have to revise the Starflight Handbook someday.
And what does it do in terms of speed, Eugene?
There's no limitation on speed. The myth of no massful object could go faster than the speed of light is just that. It's a myth. It's observed in accelerators that you have to put more and more energy in to accelerate electrons. There's no doubt about that, okay? And you do reach a limitation if you're accelerating electrons with the kind of a way they do it in accelerators. But fundamentally, there is no limit for a spaceship made out of mass, okay,
mm-hmm.
namely us or a rocket ship, to go as fast as we would ever particularly want it to go.
Well, and in that
hundreds
case,
of times faster than the speed of light.
Then you may indeed be a time traveler.
No, because the there's another myth of relativity. The twin paradox is also a myth, okay? It is just wrong. The time dilation is not part of the universe. It just isn't. No matter how many times they will tell you about muons changing their decay patterns, coming through the atmosphere and so forth, and this proves supposedly time dilation, they can say it as long as they want, but there is no such thing. Time dilation is a myth.
Why do you believe that there was not a Big Bang that kicked everything into
okay,
direction? By the way,
a lot of reasons, completely independent of theories of ether energy, totally independent of that.
I don't necessarily believe that either, by the way.
Well, okay, but all one has to do is observe, read an excellent book that we sell by the famous astronomer Halton Arp, A-R-P, who has made observations of quasars that are associated with galaxies. And these quasars, which indeed appear to be provably associated with the galaxies, have high redshift, meaning by standard understanding that they would be very far away.
Sure.
The galaxy has lower redshift, and that means it's much closer by standard understandings. Now, he proved through all his observations, multiple observations, that these are common and that we have to take seriously the idea that the redshift is not a cosmological expansion of the universe whatsoever. It is caused by some other physics, and this other physics is being gradually revealed by people working on other theories of gravity and other theories of the ether. If the universe is not basically expanding the way modern fictional cosmology says it is, going back to Hubble, who himself did not necessarily believe the expansion of the universe, all he said was, for the so-called Hubble expansion, he said, yes, there is a correlation between redshift and brightness.
See, I have a hard time believing that a tiny little pin prick of a explosion
right.
created the kinds of
right.
mass that we have right
yeah.
now.
Yeah, well, it is conceptually very difficult for the average person to assimilate that. And in truth, the average person has more sense than the physicists who believe it. There was a cover of Discover magazine some time ago we made fun of in our recent issue, which shows the size of the universe at 10 to the minus 34 seconds, and it's about 2 centimeters in diameter. Now, listen, since there's no such thing as space-time, which is this combined entity that came out of special relativity, there can be no such thing as a warped space-time that gives you black holes or gives you a singularity such as Stephen Hawking talks about or others in cosmology talk about. This has gotten into complete megalomania and insanity. But let me tell you, the joke, the cosmic joke of all time is on late 20th century and early 21st century modern physics, because history will record that they went off on a tangent with relativity and special and general, and they completely fooled themselves while at the very same time making fun of such things that were giving them a hint as to the alternate physics, namely low-energy nuclear reactions, ether energy, what Rife came up with. These people ought to go back to Science 101. Science 101 is this: experiment always overrules theory.
That's true.
If you see an experiment, Feynman said it, and he was, you know, a participant, unfortunately, in another episode that was negative, and we can talk about that, the PAP engine. But if one single experiment conflicts with the theoretical prediction of a theory, that theory has a flaw.
All right, stay with us, Eugene. We're going to come right back. I want to talk with you about that PAP engine, and also, lastly, that third category called... Eugene Malov, my guest. I'm George Norrie. Of course, this is Coast to Coast AM. Eugene, before we go to the calls and later this hour, I want you to kind of relay the incredible story of Joseph Pop and his engine. But very briefly, environmental energy, what is that?
Well, there's something called the second law of thermodynamics, which says that you cannot extract from a uniform temperature reservoir energy. You know that air molecules are zipping by and there's plenty of energy
sure.
in the air. But the second law of thermodynamics says if you have this uniform temperature and you don't have a lower temperature to exhaust lower energy of a heat engine, you can't run a heat engine in a room that is just one temperature. All right? And so that prevents us from using just the ordinary energy within air, let's say, or water, or anything. Now, the second law of thermodynamics is thought of as an inviolable barrier to using environmental energy. Nikola Tesla thought otherwise, and in 1900 he wrote an essay, and we published it and commented on it, where he said, yeah, he thought he could do it, and many people since then have thought they could do it and failed. Interestingly, there have become large conferences in mainstream physics, no less. There was one in La Jolla in 2002, summer, on loopholes in the second law. And it turns out that there are many loopholes in that law, not the least of which, of course, comes from ether energy, which is a gross violation of the second law. But let's say you don't even believe in an ether. All you believe in is that air molecules and vibrating and moving can have their energy extracted and make work by some means that has not been thought of before. And the answer, it seems to be, that there are many such ways of approaching it, and I do believe that within the next 5 years or so, something like that, for this form of environmental energy, one or more devices based on this principle of taking environmental heat and turning it directly into work, a complete gross violation of the so-called second law of thermodynamics, will be done.
Now, are these three categories an evolutionary stage, or can we just go to the best one and try to work on that?
Well, I think all three should be pursued.
Okay.
That's what we're doing. We certainly cover in Infinite Energy magazine, we cover all three.
And I guess any one of them would be better than what we have right now.
Oh, of course. It would be free energy. In all cases, it would be free energy. I will draw an analogy for your listeners with a computer revolution, a personal computer revolution. At one time, certainly when I was doing my doctoral work at Harvard, we had to pay for the amount of CPU minutes or hours logged in the processing Fortran programs. Well, you give them the card deck, and, of course, the mainframe computer would click away, and a certain amount of CPU time would click away, and you'd pay for it. Your research budget would pay for it. Now we have things sitting on our desks that are constantly computing, even with a screensaver, say, or some other problem or database or any other kind of computer operation, and you're not paying for the CPU minutes that your Pentium or your PowerBook PC is on. You are paying for the electricity, but the paradigm of infinite computation in which you do not pay for computer minutes is there. The same thing is going to happen with energy. That's the ultimate paradigm shift, that there will be no continuing charge for energy. You will ultimately pay, of course, for the device.
Right.
You know, for the unit that you put in your house, whether it's with low energy nuclear reactions, ether energy, environmental energy, whatever it is, or the new solar energy, as we would say, caused by the ether. Okay?
But you never have to worry about going in not having your energy available.
Right. It will be infinite energy, literally, which is why our magazine is appropriately titled. The establishment mocks that title, infinite energy, but that's what energy is. It's infinite, and it should be free, and it is free. Life is free in some sense. Life takes from the environment things that it needs, air and water, and it turns out ether energy as well, and that's how life exists and how life started, okay? Life will eventually return to a system of governance on this planet and elsewhere in the universe that does not depend on constant paying some authority for energy. That era will come. It can't come soon enough, needless to say. And obviously, your listeners have great imaginations. It doesn't take a genius to realize that the world will be turned completely upside down when this era arrives. I do not believe it is the evil oil companies holding this back. That is not, in my opinion, what is happening. What is absolutely happening, though, is academic stupidity, the academic government complex that started the mythology that only one theory can be correct, quantum mechanics is the only thing that can be correct, relativity is the only thing that can be correct, and just as the MIT professor, may he not rest in peace, Hermann Feschbach, who said, I have 50 years of experience in nuclear physics and I know what's possible and what's impossible. That is the standard stance that is in the way of progress. And it prevents, for example, venture capitalists from looking objectively at experiments. They just go to someone else after you tell them, okay, low-energy nuclear reactions is correct. They go to their favorite physicist, and the favorite physicist says, oh, I know this is impossible. And, of course, since he has PhDs and is with MIT or Caltech or some other place, he's believed, and the outsiders are not believed.
And the
that's the
stops.
Essence of it, and that's why, my good friends, we need, for New Energy Foundation and for many other people, we need the research funds. That's the choke point. You cannot expect this work to go ahead for free. It won't happen. It just will not happen. And I know the New Age people and the groupies of many of your other wonderful programs may think that this is just going to happen by osmosis, and the reason it's not happening is because there must be something wrong with the theories and the experiments. Not true. There is nothing wrong with the theories and the experiments, but there is everything wrong with the fact that there isn't enough money in this field, and the New Energy Foundation hopes to change that.
It's too bad the Department of Energy doesn't just fund all this. Let's go
of
to
course.
The phones. You ready?
Right.
Let's go east of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast to Coast. You're on the air. Hi there.
Hi, this is Michael in Norfolk, Virginia.
Hi, Michael. Go ahead.
Thank you for the most important science program in the history of Coast to Coast AM tonight.
Wow. what a promotion that is.
Absolutely wonderful. This man is by far the most articulate to appear on this program in this area of new energy. I don't fault any of the others that have gone before him for their sincerity, and obviously they are also very brilliant men. But Dr. Malov, really talks the language of a man who can drive this thing into reality. And
just add money and mallows, and it'll be done. Sorry
well,
for that joke.
My background is fundraising.
Okay.
And I've been thinking about this problem for a long time. I've mentioned it a couple of times when I've called in. Tonight I have an idea. I think there's really only one way to do this. I think of Harry Braun. I think of Mike Brown. I think of Stan Abrams with his turning tires to tomatoes inventions.
Mm-hmm.
I think of so many others, wonderful men, Dr. Stephen Greer, of course. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's fractured. It's fragmented the way you're going about this. There has to be cohesion. We have to put the physics to work in the marketing of this.
Well, of course we do. But the problem, my good friend, and I deeply appreciate your very kind remarks about me and other people, you know... We may use vacuum energy, but we can't operate in a vacuum. I mean, we have on our staff at New Energy 2.5 people. We used to have more when we had a benefactor who was a bit more generous. We cannot rely, as we are doing now, on only one or two individuals. We have recently gotten 100 or more individual contributors. You know, we're just starting out as the New Energy Foundation, remember. The field needs support. I mean, we gave $35,000 recently. Our entire budget is $250,000 a year. And this includes salaries, okay, for people. This is absolutely crazy to publish an international magazine, under the conditions that we do, okay? We're happy that we exist at all. That's number one. Our magazine is $29.95 a year, and if, you know, if anyone in the U.S. and abroad, it's $49.95. So one very minimal thing that people can do is, of course, subscribe either on the website or elsewhere. But we need research funds for these people. I mean, the Correas need money. Cold fusion researchers need money. Dr. Mitchell Swartz needs money. I don't think, Michael, that it is essential for New Energy Foundation to necessarily go out and make firm links, that is, program links necessarily, to lots of other organizations. I think we can play a major role, and I hope others will play a major role too. We're not restrictive. We hope that everyone succeeds. But I must tell you, there's a lot of error going on. There's a lot of spinning of wheels that could be short-circuited by giving the money to the right people. I think a lot of money has been spent, and I know that's true in cold fusion. A huge amount of money has been spent, nothing compared to the money wasted in hot fusion, of course, and many other government programs. But not enough money is being spent on the critical experiments that need to be done. Example one. Dr. Professor Oriani, University of Minnesota, critical work reported at the 10th International Conference last August, okay, in Cambridge. We gave him $5,000. Fortunately, he's emeritus professor. He could have done it almost without the $5,000, but we gave him $5,000 to continue his excellent work on a new aspect of cold fusion that the cold fusion people aren't even looking at. And yet, if his research is correct, it will entirely change the perception of even the mainstream cold fusion. So I'm telling you, we don't need a shotgun. We need a very targeted rifle.
Thanks for that call, Michael. You would think one of the oil companies would say, let's set up a division as an alternative fuel source. We'll make money on it, and let's fund it.
That almost, George, that almost happened, and it's a historical record, and we commented upon that in our magazine. Amoco, in the early days after the Pons and Fleischmann announcement, made experiments. They used some of their calorimeters that they were using in some fashion to do oil prospecting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they immediately converted them to testing out the Pons-Fleischmann experiment, and they got positive results. And these positive results were driving the administration of Amoco at that time, in the spring of 1989, in the direction of getting into a big way. In fact, the scientist in charge of this reported several years later that they were ready to go with a team of maybe 150 people to get on this ASAP. But when the Department of Energy report came out in November of 1989, only 6 months or so after the announcement, and basically said, we can't find anything, what a crock that was.
Well, so
it turned off Amoco, okay?
Yeah.
It turned off research groups all over the world. In fact, the Indians at the Bhabha Atomic Research Center were going nuts over it. But as soon as they heard that the Department of Energy in the great United States said that this was nonsense, they got scared as well.
Killed the project.
Killed it.
Let's go. First time caller line, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, my name is Travis. I'm calling from AM 600 in Memphis.
Sure. Hi, Travis.
It's nice to talk to you. I have a question that relates to Nikola Tesla.
Sure, sure. Go ahead.
When he was doing his Wardenclyffe project, mm-hmm. he was supposedly setting, as the way it was described to me, and like I believe Terry Vassalatos wrote the book.
Yes.
He stated that he was trying to create a huge stream of ether
mm-hmm.
and create that as a wave of energy that would set the Earth into a certain kind of resonance.
Right.
When he would try to set that resonance, you could take another coil of some type and receive that energy mm-hmm. from that location, but it was ripped out from underneath of him by, I believe it was J.P. Morgan.
Right. Well, listen, Tesla, there's no doubt that Tesla was one of the greatest scientists of all times. There's absolutely no doubt about that. Obviously, he gave us alternating current and so forth, and radio, and although Marconi gets, unfortunately,
and about 700 other things, I guess.
Right. But Tesla was on the right track as far as the ether goes. He was right on track. And the combination, I will tell you this, the combination of what Tesla did with Tesla coils and other things and what Reich did later, the modern Teslas, namely Dr. Paulo and Alexander Correa, using that work and respectfully citing it, very precisely citing it, and writing this up in monographs that can be downloaded from their etherometry.com website, they have formed what you might call a very precise theory of the ether. It's not just hand-waving. It's equations, it's experiments above all, and it is the legacy that Tesla left us. Someday, Tesla and Reich will be looked upon as some of the most important scientists of all time, whereas right today, of course, they are poo-pooed completely
mm-hmm.
by the establishment.
It's only programs like this that give them any kind of recognition.
That's correct. They were brilliant scientists, and I must say that my own prejudices, which were unfounded, and I should be ashamed of myself, for not having gotten into investigating what Reich himself said much earlier. It shows how prejudice pervaded by the establishment has its effect.
It affects even you, Eugene. Stay with us. We'll be back with you and more phone calls. Just a moment. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Mello, let's take some more calls, and then maybe toward the end of the show you can tell us a little bit about the Joseph Popp noble gas engine.
Yes, I will.
Let us go. Who's been waiting so long? Wildcard line, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good evening, George. Dr. Mello.
Yes, sir.
I have two quick questions for you. Number one, if the United States federal government is aware of this coal fusion energy, why haven't they applied it to our usable standings now?
Our what standings?
Usable standings, such as in automobiles, houses, and that type of stuff.
Well, the United States government employs scientists within its structure and employs, employs university scientists, all of whom are on record, quite publicly so, calling this utter nonsense. In other words, their opinion was formed very early on that the claims and the statements by Drs. Pons and Fleischmann and those who confirmed their work afterwards were fallacious. Okay, they went on record. I mean, one, a hot fusion researcher by the name of Dr. William Happer, still at Princeton, I believe, he told one journalist who wrote a very negative book against cold fusion, he said, just by looking at Fleischmann and Pons on television, you could tell they were incompetent boobs. Now, when you have that person on the panel that was supposedly giving an objective review, then you know that he doesn't, to his core, believe it. He does not, probably to this day.
What about UFOs? Do you believe that UFOs will possibly use some type of ether energy, seeing the fact that its ratio for speed is such as that?
Right. Yeah, if UFOs are real extraterrestrial spacecraft, and I'm not saying they are, they may well be for all I know, I think there's a strong possibility of that, I do believe that they would have to employ the physics of the universe, which is based, as far as I'm concerned, based on all the things I know today, on the ether, the energetic ether. And one could move through this ether at extremely high speeds. One could obviously tap infinite amounts of energy. Listen, if today devices on Earth that I've told about and that are on our website and in our magazines, our journals, that can do these things right now, that is, tap ether energy, not hydrogen energy per se, but ether energy right now. If we can do that now in a laboratory, then extraterrestrials that are many centuries, millennia ahead of us obviously have mastered this completely, and it would not surprise me at all that they are using that in their craft. And by the way, anti-gravity is another manifestation of the ether. It is a very provocative topic, but I can assure you that I have been witness to anti-gravitational effects demonstrated in the laboratory that have reduced the mass of small objects that are made of one material, gold namely, by at least 70%.
Wow.
They've gone to 95%.
I believe Boeing is working on some anti-gravity.
Unfortunately, the work they're doing is being done in a rather half-baked way, and there are many claims of anti-gravity today, but if it's done improperly or not based on the right kind of theoretical models, you will have very poor results.
Next up, let's go west of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hello, George. This is Chris in Fairbanks, Alaska.
Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
All right. My question for Dr. Maloff is, well, there's a couple things, really. You mentioned the Wilhelm Reich experiment with the thermometers.
Yes, indeed.
A friend of mine and I actually did that in 1990. We found a book in our college library that described how to do it.
How'd you do it?
Well, we built basically it was a 1 foot by 1 foot Oregon accumulator.
Yeah.
And once we realized it was actually working, we didn't have a Stirling engine, so we used this thing my mom had. It was a Christmas decoration. You light some candles, and the heat causes this little thing to spin.
Oh, yeah, I've seen those.
Yeah.
And it's on like a needle or something?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, we put it on top of it, put a glass container around it, and made sure it, you know, it got no heat from below and everything. And it actually worked.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason we did it was we were curious about the comment Einstein had made, when he looked inside one, he said, I don't want to talk about it anymore.
Well, there was a lot of correspondence which the Wilhelm Reich Museum in Rangeley, Maine, sells. It's a 100-page book of the actual copies of the letters, typewritten letters, back and forth between Reich and Einstein, or should I say Einstein and his associates, because he didn't have anything further directly to say to Reich afterwards, other than basically, go away, in so many words. But it's a shameful episode in the history of science, and unfortunately, Einstein, who died in 1955, 2 years before Reich died, could have opened the world's eyes to this true ether and created ultimately perhaps the beginnings of a unified field theory, but he missed the boat because he was not interested in pursuing the experiment, much as the physicists today say of cold fusion, oh yes, your thermometer is in the wrong place and this is, you're not doing the bookkeeping correctly and you must be making mistakes, and because you look like incompetent boobs on television, I'm not going to even investigate your experiments. I mean, the arrogance of the physics establishment is mind-boggling. And I must make another comment here, because I didn't address this at all. Human health is at stake, too, not just human welfare about the environment and our national energy policy and so forth. It turns out that the ether is part and parcel of life.
It's absolutely
part of life, and all forms of alternative medicine that work, not all forms do, healing touch, above all acupuncture, which is absolutely proved to be a real stimulus that travels from one part of the body to the other, they cannot be explained at all by conventional anatomy or conventional physics. The speed of transmission of the acupuncture signal, as done by a group at UC Irvine and in Japan and published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences of the United States in 1998, okay, proves unequivocally that acupuncture is a real physical system within the human body. Unfortunately, our mainstream publications like Science and Nature chose to refuse publication of that exemplary work, and it had to be published instead in the much more obscure Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. So the ether is part of life and will completely change medicine as well as energy.
Hey, you did a little bit of Hollywood, didn't you? A couple of years ago? Weren't you a consultant?
Oh, yes, I was a consultant to the, technical consultant to the film
The Saint,
Which used a, did not write the script, of course, but Elizabeth Shue, Val Kilmer, had a nice program and a movie, and dealt with cold fusion as the theme. And honestly, some of the wonderful words that Elizabeth Shue uttered were written by yours truly.
Excellent. I like that movie.
It was good. I like Elizabeth Shue, of course.
East of the Rockies, welcome to Coast. Ty there.
Hi, George. How's it going?
Good.
Yes, I wanted to ask you, guest, what do you think about dimensional energy?
Well, when we get into the question of, I have a very low opinion, actually, of alternate dimensions.
Uh-huh.
The dimensions of space that we have and time are quite enough for me. Actually, there's no such thing, in my opinion, as space-time.
Okay, well,
And so, therefore, I don't believe in 5th, 6th, 7th, and 26th dimensions, which is the rage today with string theory and all this other gobbledygook of the physics establishment. I'll believe in extra dimensions if they can relate it to the experimental evidence of Tesla, Reich, the Correas, and cold fusion.
Okay, well, what I basically meant by that statement was, you know, when you look up in the horizon, that's one dimension. A piece of paper is two dimensions,
yep.
You know, three dimensions and four
yep.
dimensions and so on. Well, everything has dimensions. You know, we have dimensions. Molecules have dimensions. And, I mean, our galaxy, our solar system is just one giant molecule. You know,
I don't think our galaxy is a molecule.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, you know, it can be related to... But
now, there are different sizes of things, of course, and there are different scales in the universe. But when we go down into the microcosm, we find different things and different realities than the larger structure of the universe. They're not just similar, okay? There, you can make analogies between, let's say, one thing like a solar system and something else, but that's dangerous to do. Everything starts from measurements that we make on Earth in experiments. And that's what we call science 101. Measurements are primary. Theories about the measurements are secondary.
We have a few moments left. I want to take some more calls before we're off, but give us a quick synopsis of the Joseph Papp gas engine, the Noble gas engine.
Oh, yes. It's
spelled P-A-P-P.
One of the most fascinating stories in the history of new energy. Joseph Papp was a Hungarian who came to Canada first, and then he made his way to the United States. He was a rather eccentric man, but he made an engine using an actual gasoline engine that was retrofit. No gasoline system was used in it. No cooling system was used. He claimed that he was using noble gases, that is the gases neon, krypton, xenon, helium, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And that he made mixtures of it and treated them specially and put them in the engine and made the engine work. Now, the interesting thing about this is
the engine was demonstrated on November 18th, 1968, in Gardena, California, at the company Environetics that was then helping him. And Nobel laureate from Caltech, Richard Feynman, a wonderful physicist, but then very skeptical of this. He knew in advance, so to speak, according to a story he wrote later, that Pabst's engine had to be garbage. Okay, it must have been fraud.
So he was another debunker.
He was a debunker. So he came to the meeting, and we have told this in elaborate, excruciating detail in issue 51 of our magazine, which I urge those who are curious to read in subsequent coverage. But in essence, he interfered with the demonstration of the working engine. There were about 35 to 70 people present, and the engine exploded, okay? Feynman yelled out, "This is a goddamn hoax," that is before the explosion, interfered with the control system, evidently. The engine did explode. Later, Feynman suggested that the reason it exploded, and killed one person, by the way, okay, a person, an engineer from the Mattel Toy Corporation, severely injured two other people, and, you know, caused a great stir, was headline news and so forth for a while. Feynman later said that he thought that Papp had blown up his own engine with surreptitious explosives within the engine, okay, to prevent it from being tested. Okay, this was his theory. Now, here's the problem with that theory. Later on, there was a lawsuit, and insurance companies were involved, and Caltech settled with this company, Environetics, that was helping Papp. Now, if there was evidence of real explosives that any panel had found, okay, in the investigation, would Caltech have given one red cent to anybody? Would the insurance company have?
No.
So there are two possibilities here. Either the explosion was real from an anomalous physics phenomena, which I personally believe it was, okay, or some agency in that time of 1968 was completely incompetent in investigating a situation and not determining whether or not there was dynamite or not nitroglycerin in that device. Subsequently, by the way, other people more recently have examined and tried to resurrect the PAP process and have actually succeeded in making explosions in noble gases. Noble gases, as many people listening know who know basic chemistry, are not supposed to react in any significant way. There are some reactions they undergo, but certainly you're not supposed to put electricity into noble gases and get a huge amount of extra power.
Exactly. And no exhaust came from this, apparently.
No exhaust, and the engine ran fairly
cool.
It was tested with an independent dynamometer test and was shown to run at 100 horsepower. Indeed, Papp was a very paranoid man, and he did, you know, unfortunately, take the precise mixing details and so forth and processing details to the grave with him. But the good news is that excellent scientists who have their heads screwed on are now in the process of resurrecting it. There's a good chance that it will be resurrected, in which case it would be a wonderful, possibly very dangerous, though, technology. It must be investigated.
I hate to be in a car, though, and have that engine blow up on you.
Well, absolutely. And by the way, about 3 weeks or so before that terrible tragedy in Gardena, they went out to the desert with a cannon, okay, which is it's described in one of the three patents. This cannon was particularly, it was a very thick-walled steel tube. And naval personnel from the local area, working with a TRW engineer who's still alive today, who knows a lot about this, sealed that tube so that Papp could not adulterate it with any secret explosives, okay? They took it into the desert, Papp injected it with his gases, and then he attached electricity to it, to the filaments and what have you, and it detonated with a horrendous explosion, blowing up the concrete that was surrounding it and making the steel look like a tulip afterwards. And by the way, just in the last couple of weeks, we received from a party that shall remain nameless, but in any event, we received a DVD which had the tape of that explosion, not the Gardena kill,
right,
but
right.
the one in the desert, and we are now going to distribute it all over the world for $15, and anyone who wants to see it can see the 9.5-minute stretch where PAP is putting the gas into the U.S. Navy sealed chamber, and then the thing blows up. Of course, no DVD will ever prove anything.
No.
Clearly.
No.
But this definitely shows PAP, we know what he looked like. It shows him putting the gases in from flasks. It shows the consequences. And we believe that as long as there were no illicit explosives put in there, which seems to be the case due to the Navy precautions, clearly the process was quite anomalous.
All right. We are out of time. Eugene, I wanted to get that story in because it's a fascinating story.
Thank you.
Your website, of course, infinite-energy.com. And the magazine is how much again?
It's $29.95. For 6 issues a year, or $49.95 if you're other than in North America.
All right. You do let us know if anybody develops anything, won't you?
Absolutely. Just watch our website.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much, George.